the experience machine. There are also substantial puzzles when we ask what matters other than how people's experiences feel from the inside. Suppose there were an experience machine that would give you any experience you desired. Super-duper neuropsychologists could stimulate your brain so that you would think and feel you were writing a great novel, or making a friend, or reading an interesting book. All the time you would be floating in a tank with electrodes attached to your brain. Should you plug into this machine for life, pre-programming your life's experiences? If you are worried about missing out on desirable experiences, we can suppose that business enterprises have researched thoroughly the lives of many others. You can pick and choose from their large library or smorgasbord of such experiences, selecting your life's experiences for, say, the next 2 years. After 2 years have passed, you will have 10 minutes or 10 hours out of the tank to select the experiences of your next 2 years. Of course, while in the tank, you won't know that you're there. You'll think it's all actually happening. Others can also plug in to have the experiences they want, so there's no need to stay unplugged to serve them. Ignore problems such as who will service the machines if everyone plugs in. Would you plug in? What else can matter to us other than how our lives feel from the inside? Nor should you refrain because of the few moments of distress between the moment you've decided and the moment you're plugged. What's a few moments of distress compared to a lifetime of bliss, if that's what you choose? And why feel any distress at all if your decision is the best one? What does matter to us in addition to our experiences? First, we want to do certain things and not just have the experience of doing them. In the case of certain experiences, it is only because first we want to do the actions that we want the experiences of doing them or thinking we've done them. But why do we want to do the activities rather than merely to experience them? A second reason for not plugging in is that we want to be in a certain way, to be a certain sort of person. Someone floating in a tank is an indeterminate blob. There is no answer to the question of what a person is like who has long been in the tank. Is he courageous, kind, intelligent, witty, loving? It's not merely that it's difficult to tell. There's no way he is. Plugging into the machine is a kind of suicide. It will seem to some, trapped by a picture, that nothing about what we are like can matter except as it gets reflected in our experiences. But should it be surprising that what we are is important to us? Why should we be concerned only with how our time is filled, but not with what we are? Thirdly, plugging into an experience machine limits us to a man-made reality, to a world no deeper or more important than that which people can construct. There is no actual contact with any deeper reality, though the experience of it can be simulated. Many persons desire to leave themselves open to such contact and to a plumbing of deeper significance. This clarifies the intensity of the conflict over psychoactive drugs, which some view as mere local experience machines, and others view as avenues to a deeper reality. What some view as equivalent to surrender to the experience machine, others view as following one of the reasons not to surrender. Traditional religious views differ on the point of contact with a transcendent reality. Some say that contact yields eternal bliss or nirvana, but they have not distinguished this sufficiently from merely a very long run on the experience machine. Others think it is intrinsically desirable to do the will of a higher being which created us all, though presumably no one would think this if we discovered we had been created as an object of amusement by some super-powerful child from another galaxy or dimension. Still others imagine an eventual merging with a higher reality, leaving unclear its desirability or where that merging leaves us. We learn that something matters to us in addition to experience by imagining an experience machine and then realizing that we would not use it. We can continue to imagine a sequence of machines, each designed to fill lacks suggested for the earlier machines. For example, since the experience machine doesn't meet our desire to be a certain way, imagine a transformation machine which transforms us into whatever sort of person we'd like to be, compatible with our staying us. Surely one would not use the transformation machine to become as one would wish, and thereupon plug into the experience machine. Some wouldn't use the transformation machine at all. It seems like cheating. But the one-time use of the transformation machine would not remove all challenges. There would still be obstacles for the new us to overcome, a new plateau from which to strive even higher. And is this plateau any the less earned or deserved than that provided by genetic endowment and early childhood environment? But if the transformation machine could be used indefinitely often, so that we could accomplish anything by pushing a button to transform ourselves into someone who could do it easily, there would remain no limits we need to strain against or try to transcend. Would there be anything left to do? Do some theological views place God outside of time because an omniscient, omnipotent being couldn't fill up his days? So something matters in addition to one's experiences and what one is like. Nor is the reason merely that one's experiences are unconnected with what one is like. For the experience machine might be limited to provide only experiences possible to the sort of person plugged in. Is it that we want to make a difference in the world? Consider then the result machine, which produces in the world any result you would produce and injects your vector input into any joint activity. We shall not pursue here the fascinating details of these or other machines. What is most disturbing about them is their living of our lives for us. Is it misguided to search for particular additional functions beyond the competence of machines to do for us? Perhaps what we desire is to live, an active verb, ourselves, in contact with reality. And this machines cannot do for us. Without elaborating on the implications of this, which I believe connect surprisingly with issues about free will and causal accounts of knowledge, we need merely note the intricacy of the question of what matters for people other than their experiences. Until one finds a satisfactory answer and determines that this answer does not also apply to animals, one cannot reasonably claim that only the felt experiences of animals limit what we may do to them. Underdetermination of moral theory. What about persons distinguishes them from animals, so that stringent constraints apply to how persons may be treated, yet not to how animals may be treated? Could beings from another galaxy stand to us as it is usually thought we do to animals? And if so, would they be justified in treating us as means, a la utilitarianism? Are organisms arranged in some ascending scale, so that any may be sacrificed or caused to suffer to achieve a greater total benefit for those not lower on the scale? Such an elitist hierarchical view would distinguish three moral statuses, forming an interval partition of the scale. Status 1. The being may not be sacrificed, harmed, and so on for any other organism's sake. Status 2. The being may be sacrificed, harmed, and so on, only for the sake of beings higher on the scale, but not for the sake of beings at the same level. Status 3. The being may be sacrificed, harmed, and so on, for the sake of other beings at the same or higher levels on the scale. If animals occupy status 3 and we occupy status 1, what occupies status 2? Perhaps we occupy status 2. We pass over the difficulties about deciding where on the scale to place an organism and about particular interspecies comparisons. How is it to be decided where on the scale a species goes? Is an organism, if defective, to be placed at its species level? Is it an anomaly that it might be impermissible to treat two currently identical organisms similarly? They might even be identical in future and past capacities as well, because one is a normal member of one species and the other is a subnormal member of a species higher on the scale. and the problems of interspecies interpersonal comparisons pale before those of interspecies comparisons. Is it morally forbidden to use people as means for the benefit of others, or is it only forbidden to use them for the sake of other people, that is, for beings at the same level? Do ordinary views include the possibility of more than one significant moral divide, like that between persons and animals, and might one come on the other side of human beings? Some would say that here we have a teleological view giving human beings infinite worth relative to other human beings. But a teleological theory that maximizes total value will not prohibit the sacrifice of some people for the sake of other people. Sacrificing some for others wouldn't produce a net gain, but there wouldn't be a net loss either. Since a teleological theory that gives each person's life equal weight excludes only a lowering of total value, to require that each act produce a gain in total value would exclude neutral acts, it would allow the sacrifice of one person for another. Without gimmicky devices similar to those mentioned earlier, for example, using indexical expressions in the infinitely weighted goals, or giving some goals, representing the constraints, an infinite weight of a higher order of infinity than others, even this won't quite do, and the details are very messy, views embodying a status two do not seem to be representable as teleological. This illustrates our earlier remark that teleological and side constraint do not exhaust the possible structures for a moral view. Some theological views hold that God is permitted to sacrifice people for his own purposes. We also might imagine people encountering beings from another planet who traverse in their childhood whatever stages of moral development our developmental psychologists can identify. These beings claim that they all continue on through 14 further sequential stages, each being necessary to enter the next one. However, they cannot explain to us, primitive as we are, the content and modes of reasoning of these later stages. These beings claim that we may be sacrificed for their well-being, or at least in order to preserve their higher capacities. They say that they see the truth of this now that they are in their moral maturity, though they didn't as children at what is our highest level of moral development. A story like this perhaps reminds us that a sequence of developmental stages, each a precondition for the next, may, after some point, deteriorate rather than progress. It would be no recommendation of senility to point out that, in order to reach it, one must have passed first through other stages. Do our moral views permit our sacrifice for the sake of these beings' higher capacities, including their moral ones? This decision is not easily disentangled from the epistemological effects of contemplating the existence of such moral authorities who differ from us, while we admit that, being fallible, we may be wrong. A similar effect would obtain even if we happened not to know which view of the matter these other beings actually held. Beings who occupy the intermediate status too will be sacrificable, but not for the sake of beings at the same or lower levels. If they never encounter or know of or affect beings higher in the hierarchy, then they will occupy the highest level for every situation they actually encounter and deliberate over. It will be as if an absolute side constraint prohibits their being sacrificed for any purpose. Two very different moral theories, the elitist hierarchical theory placing people in status two, and the absolute side constraint theory, yield exactly the same moral judgments for the situations people actually have faced, and account equally well for almost all of the moral judgments we have made. Almost all because we make judgments about hypothetical situations, and these may include some involving super beings from another planet. This is not the philosopher's vision of two alternative theories accounting equally well for all of the possible data, nor is it merely the claim that by various gimmicks a side constraint view can be put into the form of a maximizing view. Rather, the two alternative theories account for all of the actual data, the data about cases we have encountered heretofore. yet they diverge significantly for certain other hypothetical situations. It would not be surprising if we found it difficult to decide which theory to believe, for we have not been obliged to think about these situations. They are not the situations that shaped our views. Yet the issues do not concern merely whether superior beings may sacrifice us for their sakes. They also concern what we ought to do. For if there are other such beings, the elitist hierarchical view does not collapse into the Kantian side-constraint view, as far as we are concerned. A person may not sacrifice one of his fellows for his own benefit or that of another of his fellows, but may he sacrifice one of his fellows for the benefit of the higher beings? We also will be interested in the question of whether the higher beings may sacrifice us for their own benefit. What are constraints based upon? Such questions do not press upon us as practical problems yet, but they force us to consider fundamental issues about the foundations of our moral views. First, is our moral view a side-constraint view, or a view of a more complicated hierarchical structure? And second, in virtue of precisely what characteristics of persons are their moral constraints on how they may treat each other or be treated? We also want to understand why these characteristics connect with these constraints. And perhaps we want these characteristics not to be had by animals, or not had by them in as high a degree. It would appear that a person's characteristics, by virtue of which others are constrained in their treatment of him, must themselves be valuable characteristics. How else are we to understand why something so valuable emerges from them? This natural assumption is worth further scrutiny. The traditional proposals for the important individuating characteristic connected with moral constraints are the following: sentient and self-conscious, rational, capable of using abstract concepts, not tied to responses to immediate stimuli, possessing free will, being a moral agent capable of guiding its behavior by moral principles and capable of engaging in mutual limitation of conduct, having a soul. Let us ignore questions about how these notions are precisely to be understood and whether the characteristics are possessed, and possessed uniquely by man, and instead seek their connection with moral constraints on others. Leaving aside the last on the list, each of them seems insufficient to forge the requisite connection. Why is the fact that a being is very smart or foresightful or has an IQ above a certain threshold a reason to limit specifically how we treat it? Would beings even more intelligent than we have the right not to limit themselves with regard to us? Or what is the significance of any purported crucial threshold? If a being is capable of choosing autonomously among alternatives, is there some reason to let it do so? Are autonomous choices intrinsically good? If a being could make only once an autonomous choice, say between flavors of ice cream on a particular occasion, and would forget immediately afterwards, would there be strong reasons to allow it to choose? That a being can agree with others to mutual rule-governed limitations on conduct shows that it can observe limits, but it does not show which limits should be observed toward it. No abstaining from murdering it, or why any limits should be observed at all. An intervening variable M is needed for which the listed traits are individually necessary, perhaps jointly sufficient. At least we should be able to see what needs to be added to obtain M, and which has a perspicuous and convincing connection to moral constraints on behavior toward someone with M. Also, in the light of M, we should be in a position to see why others have concentrated on the traits of rationality, free will, and moral agency. This will be easier if the traits are not merely necessary conditions for M, but also are important components of M, or important means to M. But haven't we been unfair in treating rationality, free will, and moral agency individually and separately? In conjunction, don't they add up to something whose significance is clear? A being able to formulate long-term plans for its life, able to consider and decide on the basis of abstract principles or considerations it formulates to itself, and hence not merely the plaything of immediate stimuli, a being that limits its own behavior in accordance with some principles or picture it has of what an appropriate life is for itself and others, and so on. However, this exceeds the three listed traits. We can distinguish theoretically between long-term planning and an overall conception of a life that guides particular decisions, and the three traits that are their basis. For a being could possess these three traits and yet also have built into it some particular barrier that prevents it from operating in terms of an overall conception of its life and what it is to add up to. So let us add, as an additional feature, the ability to regulate and guide its life in accordance with some overall conception it chooses to accept. Such an overall conception, and knowing how we are doing in terms of it, is important to the kind of goals we formulate for ourselves and the kind of beings we are. Think how different we would be, and how differently it would be legitimate to treat us, if we were all amnesiacs, forgetting each evening as we slept the happenings of the preceding day. Even if by accident someone were to pick up each day where he left off the previous day, living in accordance with a coherent conception an aware individual might have chosen, he still would not be leading the other's sort of life. His life would parallel the other life, but it would not be integrated in the same way. What is the moral importance of this additional ability to form a picture of one's whole life, or at least of significant chunks of it, and to act in terms of some overall conception of the life one wishes to lead? Why not interfere with someone else's shaping of his own life? And what of those not actively shaping their lives, but drifting with the forces that play upon them? One might note that anyone might come up with the pattern of life you would wish to adopt. Since one cannot predict in advance that someone won't, it is in your self-interest to allow another to pursue his conception of life as he sees it. You may learn to emulate or avoid or modify from his example. This prudential argument seems insufficient. I conjecture that the answer is connected with that elusive and difficult notion, the meaning of life. A person's shaping his life in accordance with some overall plan is his way of giving meaning to his life. Only a being with the capacity to so shape his life can have or strive for meaningful life. But even supposing that we could elaborate and clarify this notion satisfactorily, we would face many difficult questions. Is the capacity so to shape a life itself the capacity to have or strive for a life with meaning, or is something else required? For ethics, might the content of the attribute of having a soul simply be that the being strives, or is capable of striving, to give meaning to its life? Why are there constraints on how we may treat beings shaping their lives? Are certain modes of treatment incompatible with their having meaningful lives? And even if so, why not destroy meaningful lives? Or why not replace happiness with meaningfulness within utilitarian theory and maximize the total meaningfulness score of the persons of the world? Or does the notion of the meaningfulness of a life enter into ethics in a different fashion? This notion, we should note, has the right feel as something that might help us to bridge an is-ought gap. It appropriately seems to straddle the two. Suppose, for example, that one could show that if a person acted in certain ways, his life would be meaningless. Would this be a hypothetical or a categorical imperative? Would one need to answer the further question, but why shouldn't my life be meaningless? Or suppose that acting in a certain way toward others was itself a way of granting that one's own life, and those very actions, was meaningless. Mightn't this, resembling a pragmatic contradiction, lead at least to a status two conclusion of side constraints in behavior to all other human beings? I hope to grapple with these and related issues on another occasion. The individualist anarchist. We have surveyed the important issues underlying the view that moral side constraints limit how people may behave to each other, and we may return now to the private protection scheme. A system of private protection, even when one protective agency is dominant in a geographical territory, appears to fall short of a state. It apparently does not provide protection for everyone in its territory, as does a state, and it apparently does not possess or claim the sort of monopoly over the use of force necessary to a state. In our earlier terminology, it apparently does not constitute a minimal state, and it apparently does not even constitute an ultra-minimal state. These very ways in which the dominant protective agency or association in a territory apparently falls short of being a state provide the focus of the individualist anarchist's complaint against the state. For he holds that when the state monopolizes the use of force in a territory and punishes others who violate its monopoly, and when the state provides protection for everyone by forcing some to purchase protection for others, it violates moral side constraints on how individuals may be treated. Hence, he concludes, the state itself is intrinsically immoral. The state grants that under some circumstances it is legitimate to punish persons who violate the rights of others, for it itself does so. How then does it arrogate to itself the right to forbid private exaction of justice by other non-aggressive individuals whose rights have been violated? What right does the private exactor of justice violate that is not violated also by the state when it punishes? When a group of persons constitute themselves as the state and begin to punish and forbid others from doing likewise, is there some right these others would violate that they themselves do not? By what right, then, can the state and its officials claim a unique right, a privilege, with regard to force, and enforce this monopoly? If the private exactor of justice violates no one's rights, then punishing him for his actions, actions state officials also perform, violates his rights and hence violates moral side constraints. Monopolizing the use of force, then, on this view, is itself immoral, as is redistribution through the compulsory tax apparatus of the state. Peaceful individuals minding their own business are not violating the rights of others. It does not constitute a violation of someone's rights to refrain from purchasing something for him that you have not entered specifically into an obligation to buy. Hence, so the argument continues, when the state threatens someone with punishment if he does not contribute to the protection of another, it violates, and its officials violate, his rights. In threatening him with something that would be a violation of his rights if done by a private citizen, they violate moral constraints. To get to something recognizable as a state, we must show, one, how an ultra-minimal state arises out of the system of private protective associations, and two, how the ultra-minimal state is transformed into the minimal state, how it gives rise to that redistribution for the general provision of protective services that constitute it as the minimal state. To show that the minimal state is morally legitimate, to show it is not immoral itself, we must show also that these transitions in 1 and 2 each are morally legitimate. In the rest of Part 1 of this work, we show how each of these transitions occurs and is morally permissible. We argue that the first transition, from a system of private protective agencies to an ultra-minimal state, will occur by an invisible hand process in a morally permissible way that violates no one's rights. Secondly, we argue that the transition from an ultra-minimal state to a minimal state morally must occur. It would be morally impermissible for persons to maintain the monopoly in the ultra-minimal state without providing protective services for all, even if this requires specific redistribution. The operators of the ultra-minimal state are morally obligated to produce the minimal state. The remainder of Part 1, then, attempts to justify the minimal state. In Part 2, we argue that no state more powerful or extensive than the minimal state is legitimate or justifiable, hence that Part 1 justifies all that can be justified. In Part 3, we argue that the conclusion of Part 2 is not an unhappy one, that, in addition to being uniquely right, the minimal state is not uninspiring.